So here we are. We're in week three of what I guess is session five. In this session on time, and as we'll see this week, I think this is an important session to at least it has been for me, in getting a sense of what that means, you know, how we can make that move. There's an interesting parallel to space, and I want to talk about that some today. But let's start at the beginning. The key thing to be aware of here, the central theme around which this chapter, I think, is really organized, is the witness. And we've talked about the witness. We've introduced the idea of the witness in many other contexts. And I think the first time we talked about the witness, there was a sense that No matter what kind of analysis we do or how we understand our situation, there is this fundamental sense that, you know, this is real, damn it, and that there's a witness who tells us that, or who, I guess, tells us, but who is absolutely reliable on this point. So we return to that sense of the witness in this chapter. And so there's a little bit of noise here. I don't know who that is. Okay, it stopped at the moment. Okay, so we return to this notion of the witness, and the way the chapter begins is by talking about the witness and saying there are times when the witness seems very strong, seems strongest, and there's kind of an interesting dynamic because the times that our sense of reality, and that's really the way the witness is being used. It's you know, the sense of, yes, this is really real. So sometimes we feel most alive, and aliveness and realness and the sense that we're talking about are pretty much the same thing. You know, it's not the realness of pounding on a table and saying, well, the table must be real, because look, it hurts when I hit my hand on it. That's one way of thinking about real. But here we're thinking about real more in the sense of the realness of our experience. And maybe a way to think about that is to compare it to a dream. You know, most dreams are not as real. Sometimes a dream seems very real, and those are unusual dreams. But mostly, you know, while we're dreaming, it seems real enough. It seems as real as we can imagine something being inside the dream. But when we wake up from the dream, if we look back, it has a dreamlike feeling to it, which means it's not as real. Okay, so there's kind of a continuum. There's dreamlike reality, or you might say the reality that comes up in fantasies, for instance. And then there's the reality of our ordinary waking life, which seems absolutely real. But what the opening of the chapter here talks about is that sometimes things seem even more real. We feel so engaged, so alive. It's more the aliveness, I think, that's being pointed to here. And Rinpoche speaks about that at the very beginning of the chapter in terms of an underlying energy. Right? We seem more in tune, I'm reading from the first sentence, we seem more in tune with the underlying energy that makes experience into a coherent whole, more free from the influence of interpretive structures. So, you know, we're always busy making sense out of things, that's the interpretive structure, but what we make sense out of has its own aliveness, its own underlying energy. And I think what Rinpoche is pointing to here is exactly where we would like to be able to go in a sense. I mean, we have to think that through and work it out. But it's in one way, it's very much like space, you know, the way we've been, we were working with space in the last session. And in another way, it's rather different from space. The thing about space is that we ordinarily experience it as nothing at all. We've certainly gone into that quite a bit. In fact, there is a presence to space which has to do with its capacity to allow, but also has to do with the presence of the field. You know, space is present. We talked about this quite a bit in the last session. Space is present as the field of all possible experience. So what we were working with when we worked with space was to activate that field, you could say. And in doing that, we move away from our ordinary understanding, which is that space is nothing at all. Okay, so now what's the parallel with time? Well, our ordinary understanding of time is that it is the sequence of moments that moves from past to present to future, this linear sequence. What is it that we're wanting to move toward in activating the time-space knowledge vision? Well, I think it's exactly what Rinpoche is pointing towards here. It's this underlying energy within experience, it's in a certain sense the substance out of which experience is made, although substance is not at all the right word because, of course, it's too substantial. But it's kind of it's parallel to the field in space. You know, just as it doesn't really make sense to say that space is nothing at all, it doesn't really make sense to say that time is just the sequence of moments from past to present and future, because underneath that, or within it, or as the heart of it, or underlying it, as Rinpoche says here, there's this energy, there's this aliveness, and that is the dimension, the vision, let's say, of time that we would like to be able to activate. And by activate here, that partly just means have access to it. You know, let that be the reality of our experience. And so what Rinpoche said at the beginning of this chapter is that sometimes that happens more or less spontaneously. We feel more alive. We feel more real. And those times are special for us, you know? And they also give us access to a certain kind of knowing and a certain kind of capacity. As he says, energy and awareness and concentration are united and in balance, and there's a genuine dynamic and a power. We can focus our minds, we can balance our energy, all these nice things that he says in the first paragraph. It all has to do with the aliveness, which is really, whether you want to say that is the witness or that's the kind of the truth that the witness testifies to or bears witness to, as we say in English. It's that realness that is a possible gateway, you could say, to a different vision of time. So we've got this duality set up, which is a lot like the duality that we were exploring in space. And you know, I think I'm really trying to emphasize the connection, because I think that there's a coherence to the way that space and time are presented. And there are other aspects, you know, in some ways exploring space is very different from exploring time. But there's also a kind of a coherence that it's good for us to have a sense of. I think it helps tune us in to what I would, to what I see as the heart of the TSK vision. We are moving away from our ordinary understanding, which is all in terms of past and present and future. And as we will see, and as we've seen already, that's very much tied in to our sense of the self as the one that's at the center, the one that knows, the one that acts, the one that owns, all the different aspects of the self that we've been exploring. That's our ordinary understanding. We are looking to move into this appreciation for the underlying energy, which is more the timing of time, the aliveness of time. So there's a passage, and by the way, you'll notice I've started with the love of knowledge material. That's really what I'm going to focus on today. I did assign the TSK, a few pages from the TSK book. We're not going to talk about those in a sustained way, but there are a couple of things that are in that TSK reading that I think are helpful here. On page 168 of the TSK book, Rinpoche says that describes time as the common dynamic factor of all manifestations, and that may be helpful in getting a little bit different sense of what it is that we're pointing towards here. So whatever shows up, whatever manifests, it shows up in time, and what we usually understand that to mean is that it shows up in a past, present, future sequence. I mean, the fact that it shows up, I guess, means it's in the present, but we just automatically assign it a past and a future, no matter whether it's just some thing, like the telephone on my desk, or some sequence of events, somebody walks through the door, and we don't imagine or tell ourselves that that person who walked through the door has just popped out of nowhere. We say, no, they came from somewhere, and later they'll be going to somewhere. So ordinarily we say things show up in time, but now we're focusing a little differently. We're focusing on time, to use that language from the TSK book again, as the common dynamic factor of all manifestations. So whatever shows up, it doesn't matter what shows up. That's just the content. That's like objects in space. Of course, it's important for making sense of our world, but in terms of understanding space and now understanding time, that's not where we want to go. We want to go to this underlying energy or this common dynamic factor. And again, in the TSK reading, one of the points that's made in that reading is that a way to be able to tune into that is through an appreciation for space. You start with space. That's how the TSK book presents it. And almost all of the books in the TSK series, the exception is Knowledge of Time and Space, almost all of them start with space. And we have been moving, as we've gone through our sequences, we've started with space. And I think it's because you get a stronger sense with space, or I don't know, maybe it's easier for some people, maybe not for everybody, but you do get a sense that the content of experience is not where we want to focus. And with time, you can say the same thing. The events that show up in time, of course that's important. Of course we can't ignore it. That's what our experience is a series of events. But that's not what time is. Time is the common dynamic factor in all showings up, in all manifestations. Okay, Michael has a question here, or a comment. It seems inherently more difficult to point to an alternative to linear time than an alternative to substantial space. Space can be assigned an address, a place, and therefore an underlying greater space can be pointed to, but how do we point to a time that underlies linear time? Okay, well, that's well said, and it's very consistent with what I've been thinking about in preparing for this class, but I'm not quite sure what to make of my own understanding or what Michael says here. So I have the same sense that when we went through space, we began to see how we could look at this sense of space as a field, which immediately meant that it wasn't empty but full. It's the realm of everything at all, anything at all, manifesting, showing up. And there's a certain, I don't know, maybe you could say a plausibility to that. And so the field-centered orientation towards space is a kind of a nice transition. I mean, it's not the final word with respect to the TSK vision. There is no final word. There is no final word with respect to the TSK vision. But it's not saying, if I can just see things in terms of a field, then I've done it, you know. Now I've mastered TSK. No, but it's a very important move. And it seems to be inherently plausible. With time, I too find it more difficult to come to a transitional space. And that's exactly, or transitional understanding of time. Now, it's not more difficult in the sense that you can't name it, because really I think Rinpoche has named it here. You know, he says there's this underlying energy that is more free from the influence of interpretive structures, right? And there's a kind of a special realness, a special aliveness. So you can name it, but what's the move you make to go there? And that is exactly what I've been thinking about a lot and kind of working with a lot in this last week, because we're really looking at that central issue in right now. And it is central to activating the vision. And so I will have some things to say about it, but my only hesitation is that although that makes a lot of sense to me, that's my experience, and Michael is saying that that's his experience too. It's good to remember that Rinpoche says that in the front matter of Love of Knowledge, that different people are different, and for some people, time is just inherently the dimension of the vision, the facet of the vision that's easiest to connect with, and for other people, space is the facet of the vision, and for other people, knowledge. And I've always thought of myself as a space person. So maybe there are people for whom this is just intuitively obvious and intuitively plausible, and I'm just reflecting my own orientation. But either way, in a sense, it doesn't matter all that much. We still want to be exploring what time, how we can activate this other vision, this other understanding, which in at least a simple way of talking about it is this underlying energy or this this common dynamic factor in whatever shows up. So that's what we want to explore. The key mistake we make or the way we move, before I go into that, let's see what Hayward says. He comments, the deeper fabric of time into which threads of linear time is woven, or are woven, I guess, seems to work. So that's an image you're saying that you find works for you. There's a fabric of time, and Rinpoche certainly uses that image at different times. There's a fabric of time, and the threads of linear time show up within that. Well, that's great. It's a wonderful image, and it does seem to me to point in a very effective way. But I'm still looking for, how do you activate that? I mean, so one way to ask the question would be, what exercise can you do? Is there a particular exercise or a particular orientation or a walkabout? And I want to work with that today. I will say that one place where I think it shows up very clearly, one practice that is very helpful in this regard, and it's why it's a practice that was assigned for this week, I guess, is going without going. Because, you know, that's the very slow walking. And we usually do that on retreat. And that's, I guess, my bias. Because I find it hard to do on my own, somehow. It just seems to work better when you can, also when you can take more time with it. But if you did do it during the week, the reason why that seems to be very much connected to this central question of how we can touch the underlying dynamic of time, the reason why it seems to work so well is that it's asking you to give up the usual forward-directed momentum. So that's one way of thinking about it. Now, Ron makes a couple of points here. He says, and I think he's speaking to this question of, well, why would it be difficult? Is it really inherently more difficult to activate a different vision of time than of space? And he says, well, time is more threatening to the self because death is a reminder of the self's vulnerability. Space seems more comforting. Yeah, again, that makes good sense to me. But, you know, again, people may not always react the same way. Probably I've quoted at some point here this famous saying by Pascal, who was a 17th century Western philosopher, who says, the vast silence of infinite space terrifies me. Now, that space in our ordinary empty space kind of understanding that he's talking about. But I think it is possible for people to be deeply disturbed by the sense of space as nothing at all. And of course, one of the things Rinpoche writes about when he talks about space and what the problem is, you know, why is space problematic, is he talks about feeling, you know, things are crowded. We feel pushed around. We feel closed in. So people can have that kind of experience. But it's true, I think, that the self has a special relationship to time. And that's one of the things that gets talked about in this chapter, and we've looked at it before, is the self really, in order to come into being as a self, it has to be a story, right? You have to have an identity that unfolds over time. And so, yes, it's more difficult, it seems like, to engage time. But if there's anybody out there who says, no, time, that's the water I swim in, that I feel really at home with time. And space is very tricky. So Ron actually went on to say what I was just saying. You could feel space as a nothingness and the sense of the self is disappearing into nothing. So yeah, I mean, death is the end of space and time, I suppose. Okay. Now, there's a fundamental move here, and I do want us to look at that and practice with it so we can go into that right now. And that is that, we are very easily led into an engagement with the story that the witness testifies to. So if you think about the image of a witness, and the idea here is a witness in a trial, you know, a legal proceeding, the witness gets up on the stand, you know, and tells the court what happened, right? So the witness is all about stories. And about testimony, the witness testifies. I'm being kind of careful with these words because I think for people who are not native English speakers, this may not be a vocabulary that you're very used to. So I want to make sure it's clear. Now, I looked up the word testify or testimony, and actually it just comes from the word for witness. The Latin word was, I don't remember exactly, testis or something. The witness, when he testifies, or she testifies, is just being a witness, is just presenting the way things are. That's what the witness does. what we do, our response to that is to put all our attention on what the witness is saying and not put our attention on the witness as such. And that's, in one way, it's a subtle difference, subtle distinction, but in another way, it's not so subtle. I mean, if you imagine in a trial, you are listening to what the witness says, but you're also trying to judge the reliability of the witness. But we kind of forget about the witness, or at least maybe we'd say the witness has already established its credentials. You know, this is the witness that is telling us the way things are. And so it doesn't occur to us to question the witness. And all that comes up very clearly at the top of page 194. Because it's talking about exactly this distinction. The witness tells a story, and the story is a story of the self. Ron says, so we could think of it as being an expert witness. And yeah, I think that's right. We accept the credentials of the witness. The witness has authority, and we don't ordinarily even consider the possibility that we could question the witness. I mean, yeah, let's just leave it at that. So let's take a look at the top of 194. So ordinarily, the witness tells us the story of what unfolds in linear time. This happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And we ignore or miss this deeper energy, this deeper dynamic at work within the story. That's the sort of fundamental distinction that's being missed. So let's read the paragraph. Remco has a comment we'll look at after this. So on the top of 194, the text raises the question of what would happen if we understood the witness to be testifying about this deeper dynamic. And Rinpoche says, if the witness were speaking of this deeper time, the usual interpretations that we give its message might prove ill-founded and misleading. The three aspects of time, past, present, and future, might be understood as markers. That is, if we were understanding the witness's testimony in terms of the deeper time, which really is somehow more fundamental to the witness, if we were understanding that, then the three aspects of our ordinary time, past, present, and future, might be understood as markers for an underlying dynamism of transition and change within which body, mind, and universe take form. The structure of self in the world might yield to a way of being at once more open and more free. If the story of the self proved to be only another story, conditioning and limitations would fall away. Time, space, and knowledge could perhaps bear witness in a completely new way. That's what we'd like to activate. You know, it's all stated very clearly here, I think. That doesn't mean we know yet, you know, how to activate it. Now, what Remco says may help point in that direction. He says, doing lots of body work, like Qigong, Kumye, or yoga, really helps to experience a presenting without emphasizing something that is presented. Working with the body helped me a lot to contact the same energy that marriage of sound and breath also can present. So, yes, marriage of sound and breath is another exercise that most of you are probably familiar with from the first TSK book, that is very much a time exercise, where you kind of let go of the labeling, the identification, the storytelling, and you move to a kind of a deeper energy. And the point Remco's making here is that body work that activates energy, a certain kind of energy, the kind of flowing energy especially, also goes in this direction. I think that's absolutely right. You know, I think there's a lot to be done with time and the dynamic of time manifesting through the body and through movement in the body. That seems to me a really important area. It's not one that I've investigated a lot, and I think there are other people who could do it better. But it's interesting, if you think about it in terms of Kumye, for those of you who are familiar with Kumye, and a number of you are, so that's, you know, nowadays we call that Tibetan yoga, but it's a practice that Rinpoche introduced, and it, people have been developing it for a long time. You can look at Kumye, and you can look at the way it's presented in the Kumye books, in terms of time and in terms of space, but it seems much more natural. I shouldn't say more natural. The focus, like if you just look at the names of the exercises, and because you're taking certain positions and you're moving through space, it seems natural to look at Kumye in terms of space. But it seems just as natural to look at it in terms of time, because you are moving. Almost all Kumye exercises involve some kind of movement. And that might be a wonderful way. And I mean, I think it is a wonderful way. And if not Kumye, then there are other practices which also, you know, put you more immediately in contact with this dynamic that we're investigating here. So why not just stop and do those practices? Well, because we have put in place these structures of witnessing. So, you know, the word wit, after all, the older meaning of the word wit is to know. You can still see that in Shakespeare's plays. He uses it that way sometimes. So the witness is the one who knows, and the witness has a certain kind of knowing. And if we don't challenge that way of witnessing, so the witness always is telling this story. That's the way he knows. It's always telling us about what's going on, the story of what's happening. If we leave that in place, if we don't challenge it, then we will not go to a deep enough level in activating a different vision of time and space. So as a practice, as an approach that can activate time, I think what you say, Remco, is great, but it's very important to keep that in mind. And that's, again, the exercise going without going is a movement exercise. Unlike Kumye, there are not many movement exercises in TSK. But that's one, and I think that's one reason why it seems to be a natural place to look for this dynamic of time. But what we ordinarily do is understand the testimony of the witness in terms of the content of what's said, the story of what's told. So there's a portion of a place in this book, Love of Knowledge, toward the end of the book. It's an area that I really haven't worked with in terms of teaching it very much, because I think it's quite challenging. At least that's what I tell myself as a reason. And it has to do with what Rinpoche calls the ness. And what he means by the ness is the sense of realness that goes with a story. You know, when you tell a story, there's the realness of the aliveness, and that's what we've talked about until now. But you know, the story also claims that the events being narrated are real in the sense of yes, this really happened. You know? And that realness is presented just linguistically very often in English. It's presented with the ness as the kind of essence of what's going on. So you talk about the whiteness of white, or the trueness of true, or you know, there are countless examples in English. And at one point in that discussion, Rinpoche again brings up the witness. And he says, it's on page 384, if you want to look at it in context of Love of Knowledge. He says, the witness witnesses no-ness, which is a very difficult statement if you just take it out of context. But we have a context now in terms of what we're talking about right now. And that is that when the witness tells a story, it's claiming that the story is about is real in the sense of, yes, that's the way things really are. That's the ness, as Rinpoche also says, of these claims of the witness. But if you see it from a different perspective, what you see is the dynamic, which manifests in the witness's telling. But whatever the content of the story, there isn't really anything there. So the witnesses no ness. There's no whiteness. There's no I-ness. There's no self-ness. There's no worldness. That's kind of the way Rinpoche uses that sense of ness. And so it's just the ness of witness is, it's very interesting to ask, well, how is that ness related? I just wanted to bring it up. I don't want to make that the main point. So I would like for us, because I think this is the transition we want to make, I would like for us to just practice with that in a very direct way right now. So to take 2 or 3 minutes, say at least 3, because this is, seems like we need 3. take a few minutes now and just let experience arise with the focus, with your awareness directed toward the energy of the arising instead of whatever the content is. The content is there. You just automatically know that, right? But what we want to do is be aware of the aliveness of the arising. That's what we're talking about. That really is what we're talking about. So the question is, could we just go there? I mean, who needs some special, practice or mechanism? Let's just go there. See what happens. So let's try that, okay? For a few minutes. The aliveness of what presents itself. Let's try that. Okay. So, as always, I invite you to share something of your experience. Yes? Would you like to say something? Okay, so I'm not, there is a little trouble with hearing you, so I'm just going to repeat that, or maybe not word for word, but it's a quote from a well-known quote by a Tibetan master. Since everything is but an apparition, having nothing to do with good or bad, acceptance or rejection, one may well burst into laughter. And yes, I think that that's a wonderful perspective to bring into this, or it's really another way of pointing toward the same fundamental point. If we go back to that quote from the TSK book, which says, time is the common dynamic factor of all manifestations. So a manifestation, you could also think of as an apparition. There's a lot of noise coming from number three, so I'm going to, I think it's number three. So if I could figure out how, I would mute number three. No, I don't know how to do it. Okay, anyway, the noise stopped. Manifestations, apparitions, when we look at the dynamic, then what manifests loses its nest, you know, loses its solidity, loses its identity. And becomes just something like an apparition, something that appears. And at that level, you could say the usual distinctions we rely on, the good and the bad and the positive and the negative and so on, all of that loses its force. So I think that's what that quote is pointing towards also. So that's helpful. Thank you. So David says, with arisings that appear, I notice a fullness, a widening or relaxing of focus, a lightness of being, and an underlying feeling of well-being. Okay. Okay, good. So something shifts. You know, if we can move to the aliveness of time instead of putting all our effort and energy into the what it is that shows up in time, which has to do with identities, which has to do with stories, which has to do with linear time, which has to do with the self, all that complex, then there is a kind of an opening. And what you say, David, is related to what Rinpoche, the way Rinpoche describes this in these opening pages. You know, conditioning and limitations, he says, would fall away. So Eliana says, it came to my mind the exercise subject-object reversal. And bringing it helps to weaken the to and from energy. When I do this, I can feel a warm and bright connection. I think that would be a great way to practice. That exercise has been assigned in the program, so I'm assuming everybody's familiar with it. You know, one of the points people always make when they talk about physics and trying to make sense out of modern physics is that the arrow of time, so the past, present, future unfolding of time, which is at the heart of our ordinary sense of time, in physics there's no room for that. There's no, all of the things that happen, all of the events that formulas in physics describe could just as well move backward in time as forward in time. And the possibility that we could reverse the connection between subject and object, that the object, without losing its quality as object, could take on all of the attributes, you might say, of the subject, is a way of running things backwards. And when that happens, of course, then the story loses a lot of its hold on us. And the limits that it imposes lose a lot of its hold. So you described that, Eliana, or something like that, in terms of a warm and bright connection and a weakening of our usual to and from energy. Okay. Klaus says, some things arise, others just pop up. Well, that's an interesting distinction. I don't, we're pretty much out of time, so I won't ask you to say any more about it. But things popping up, for me, the example of something popping up is when suddenly you find yourself thinking about something completely different. You've been involved with something and then a completely different thought comes up. And that's not some unusual event. That happens, 10 times a minute or something. So that's something popping up. So the arising, you seem to have in mind a certain, not just popping up. There's a kind of a preparation for it to arise. I'm not sure if that's right. So if you want to say something more, maybe say it right now. We'll be stopping soon. Hayward says, appearances seem to arise in a living field, thus enlivening and animating the appearance of that presence or the appearance that presents.
Okay.
Excuse me? The appearance that presents. Okay. Okay. So, well, I like that you kind of bring together the space aspect and the time aspect by talking about a living field. That's exactly, we have looked at the field dimension and now we're looking at the living dimension and, we're turning away from the content. And that's very much the same as what we did with space, right? Objects appear in space, but if you don't focus on the objects, but on the appearing in the field, that activates a different vision. And we're saying something very similar here. If you don't focus on the events in the story, but on the dynamic that makes them possible, something fundamental shifts. So Klaus says, okay, arising connects more to the dynamic. Okay, I think I understand that. So the popping up means, oh, look, but the dynamic is the, really dynamic is where we've been focusing today. So I don't think I'll say any more than that because we do need to stop. We'll comment a little more. We didn't get too far into the reading, but I think what we're talking about here is really important. We have this question of activating the vision, and we're really engaged right in that question right now. So we'll continue to explore that, and we'll talk next week. Thank you, everybody.